The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. And Bill explains that the brainstorm is the sudden rage, as Bill sees it, he explains that. So it's the grouch, which is the long-term kind of thing, and the brainstorm, which is the sudden rage, were not for us. Here's another one of those wonderful Bill vocabulary moments. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. I have a friend who hates her ex-brother-in-law for all kinds of very understandable reasons. The ex-brother-in-law was awful to her sister, who died while this ex-brother-in-law was being awful to her sister. She hates him. She's not a compulsive overeater. She doesn't think about him very much. When she does, she wishes him ill. Really ill. Bad, bad stuff. I knew that I could not hate that person. And I had an intimate knowledge of the sister and all that. And I had every reason to hate the guy too. But I knew that if I continued to hate him, I would eat over him. Because I can't have the dubious luxury that normal people can have. They can get angry and get over it. I can't. It festers within me. We turn back to the list, the big book says, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. If you have, I'll give you a little bit of trivia stuff every so often just to show you how obsessed I am. If you have a book that says we were prepared to look for it from an entirely different angle, then your book was printed between 1985 and 1955 and 1985. But it is look at it, not look for it. Blaine was very proud of himself. He pointed this out to AA and they changed it. We began to see the world and its people really dominated us. Sure, if I can't be in the same room with someone I'm having a case against, you know, if the person who insulted my father can go into a restaurant and he doesn't even know me and I have to leave the restaurant because I want to throttle him, but he doesn't even know me. And if I said, you know, my name is Indigo, what is his name? My name is Indigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepared to die. You know, I'm not going to say that. I'm not much of a swordsman. You know, if I'm not prepared to say that, then I have to leave the room, right? If these people are killing me, and they're causing me to eat, then they're winning all the time. Hitler was winning. Hitler won the war in that sense, at least in respect to me as a Jew, was winning. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, because we will discover as we go into this that some of the wrongdoings that others we have seen others is really our they didn't do any wrong. Fancied or real had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, wrote Howe. We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. So here's the picture. We have the first three columns filled out. Okay? What bothers us? The what ifs and the if onlys and the things that we wish weren't true, column one. We have the reasons why those things are on the list. We've begun to analyze them and we're venting. This is why these things are on the list. We've got how they affect us and we're looking at this. And the only purpose of these check marks is to show you graphically how these things are killing you. If in fact you find, and you will find, a lot of checks in the places for check marks, you will begin to realize that your whole personality, self-esteem, how you think about yourself, security, how safe you feel in this world, ambitions, what you want out of life, personal relationships, sex relationships, are all affected by all these things that you've written down. And you'll realize that the world is dominating you. You cannot be a whole person. How could you possibly think straight if these things, if all these things are checked off? You know, you might not check off, you're not going to have full check marks on everything, but there's enough to show you how can you possibly be connected to the sunlight of the spirit, to your deepest beliefs, if these things are clouding your mind? The shadow knows. Only the shadow knows. I'm pretty obscure, aren't I? These things are clouding your mind. You begin to realize they're killing you. You must get rid of them. Well, the Big Book provides two ways of getting rid of the things that are killing you. First of all, you have to deal with the people who have wronged you or others, because they're the hardest to kill. You know that the things that you've done, you're going to be able to do something with when you get to steps 8 and 9. But it's the ones who have wronged you that are killing you, and they're the toughest. And my experience in OA is that because we've led a pretty lethargic life, most of us, either because we don't eat enough or because we eat too much, that our lives are basically isolated, and we all think of ourselves as nice people, and we're people pleasers, and we're lonely, and all that. Generally speaking, the people who've been on our list are people who've hurt us much more than people we've hurt. We begin to understand people we've hurt. Family, you know, we've isolated, we haven't given enough love and all that. But generally speaking, there's going to be a lot of people on that list of people who've hurt us. Some really deeply. Some have done things to us which no human being should suffer from, for some of us. And some of us, I mean, I'm just such a sensitive guy that the slightest hurt can affect me as much, I feel it as much as the deepest hurt that some people have felt, where I look at them and say, how could they survive? Just as an aside, I was once at a wonderful OA meeting, about 8 or 9 of us. It was a noontime meeting. We all went out for an absent meal after the meeting. And we were just sharing on difficult things that happened to us. And I found the fascinating, it was to my fascination, that everyone at that meeting felt sorrier for someone else than they did for themselves. It was almost like a chain. You know, well, you suffered horribly. I feel so sorry. You think I suffered. What about her? And, you know, and it went all around. There wasn't a person there for whom someone didn't feel more sorry than the other person. But we all feel these things, even though some of us, like, I don't think I'm justified in as much as someone who's been raped or sexually assaulted in some way to feel the hurt. But somehow I do. Like, or put another way, it affected me, the minor cuts and bruises I've had compared to the vicious slices that other people have suffered. But whatever it is, it certainly affected me in the same way. I wish it weren't true. So because we are dealing very often with people who have hurt us, I think it's important to spend some time on this and talk about the big book's approach to people who have hurt us. The first way is page 66, right at the bottom. This was our course. We realized the people who wronged us, these are the ones in step on column 1 who have wronged us, or wronged others as well, the people who have done harm, were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms, I think that's the column 2, the things why they're on our list. And the way these disturbed us, that's clearly column 3, the self-esteem, the pocketbooks, the ambitions. They, like ourselves, were sick too. And here's the prayer, the big book prayer to deal with these people. And you'll find that in the vertical column written there. We ask God to help us show the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. That's the prayer to say about them. God, please, so-and-so is sick. God, please grant me the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Show me the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. It used to say a friend who has cancer in the original manuscript. And I'm not sure I like that one way or the other, but it really, I used to say, and I still say, that there are many people who do things that could hurt us, but that don't because they are sick. First of all, there are people with mental problems or with brain problems who have, say, a brain tumor, Tourette's syndrome, who say things, or who are just in pain, in physical pain, and they say things, and we say, oh, we understand, they're sick people, right? We don't take offense at them. When a kid says to us, daddy or mommy, I hate you, yeah, there's a little pang there, but we know they don't hate us, generally speaking. Well, if they're 4 years old, we know they don't hate us. I mean, you know, maybe if they're 20, they do, but you know what I'm saying? Like, we accept that in so many people. When my wife and I were going to childbirth classes, they would talk about the moment of transition when I don't know if that's still, they still talk about that, but that 20-minute period when your wife will blame you for being there at conception and for causing her all the pain. 20 minutes, you're lucky. Okay. You know, don't worry. It's hormones and pain. She really loves you. That's what they told us. I don't know. Just reminds me when it's Father's Day, I say to my father, thank you for being my father. My father's response is, it was a pleasure. But anyway, that's as dirty as I get. So this whole concept is that there are people about whom we think we understand that. You know, I used to dislike a guy who was always grouchy, always awful, just a horrible person to be around, always down. And I found out that this guy had been in a fire when he was 17. He was in his 50s at the time, and had been burned all over his body. And that's why he always wore suits. I didn't understand why he was always covered up, even in the summertime. And it gets hot in Winnipeg. It gets very cold and it gets very hot. Just like Harlan, you know, in Chicago, except it's even colder. And when I found that out, and he was constantly in pain. He had third-degree burns all over his body. So he's constantly in pain. Well, I understood that. I'd be pretty grouchy if I were constantly in pain. I would not be a nice guy if I were. So it's very simple to excuse some people. Can we excuse those who are spiritually sick? Now, the Big Book does not use the word forgiveness. That is really a Christian concept. Well, there's a Jewish aspect to it, too. There's one Jewish prayer dealing with forgiveness. We ask God to forgive us, but only in one prayer that's said in the evening do we ask to forgive others. And even then, I won't bother you. It's basically a Christian concept. I've got nothing against it. There's incredible stuff been written on the power of forgiveness and all that. But the Big Book asks us to provide tolerance, pity, and patience, not forgiveness. I don't forgive Hitler for a thing. Actually, I don't have the right to forgive Hitler for anything. I wasn't the one affected. But I have tolerance, pity, and patience for the person he became. Because he was such a sick man when he died that there was no possibility of redemption for him. And, you know, I think it's a spiritual axiom. I think it's spiritually true that the harm that other people do to us rebounds on them. The more they do harm to us, the less capable they are of being human beings. The farther away they go from being human. They're not even animals. The more evil that people do, the more they harm themselves. It's an important concept for me to accept and understand, because when I come down to amends, I really have to figure out, what is the amend I owe a person who has harmed me? Well, I have allowed, if I have allowed that person to continue to harm me, as Charlie allowed his father to continue to harm him even after his death, then I'm allowing a person to continue to be less than human. If I've actually gone back into a relationship, as I did, in which I experienced harm, then I've allowed the person who harmed me to continue to do harm to me. And that harm is something I have to make amends for. It may be that I get out of the relationship. It may be that I call the police. It may be all kinds of things that, you know, to stop that person from harming him or herself. So it's a very important concept. But that's tolerance, pity, and patience. Now, that doesn't work for everyone. And the Big Book has page 552, famous page 552, in which a person who has a resentment with her mother, she's been sober for, I think it's 20 years, knows that if she doesn't get over this resentment, she'll go back to drinking. Whole interesting backstory with that person, which I wouldn't bore you with if I told it, but I have no time for it. But at any rate, she reads an article in the magazine, which to this day has not yet been identified. There have been a correspondence with so many historians. Some people say it was Emmett Fox and the Sermon on the Mount, or Emmett Fox and the power of, not the power of positive thinking, but the power of positive something. It's not. It's not in those two books anyway. But the person who wrote it, supposedly wrote it, says, if you have resentment that you cannot get rid of, pray for that person to have what you want out of life. Pray for that person every day, whether you mean it or not, and within 2 weeks, your resentment will be gone. Well, I had this lawyer. I had Hitler. I had a couple of other people on the list. And I prayed for them. But wait a minute. If I'm going to pray for someone to have what I want out of life, don't I have to know what I want out of life? And by this time in the process, it seems to me I'm at a point where the kind of thing, what I want out of life is something like, you know, you can fill in your own blanks, peace, serenity, love, the ability to love and to be loved, the feeling of usefulness. I mean, these are the things I really want out of life. And when I pray for people to have that, it didn't take me more than one prayer, maybe two prayers, to realize that the people I was praying for didn't have that. How did Hitler die? Completely unuseful, completely non-human, no ability to love, no ability to be loved, completely delusional. The lawyer, well, I began to look at this lawyer who's dead now. He died at the age of 50-something of alcoholism, an alcoholic. Four wives. Children from the first two wives wouldn't talk to him because of how he had treated his first two wives. Smoker, and living an absolute lie. People thought he had ethics and he didn't. I felt so sorry for the man. And this is while I was in a case with him. I have pity for him, tolerance and patience. So, I can only speak from the experience of friends of mine who have been horribly, violently dealt with by people who have been really horrible to them, like far beyond anything I experienced. They have found the same release. They have realized that the more that person harmed them, that person never was able to get out of it. That person became less and less of a human being, and thus that person was no longer capable of redemption. Many of you, I'm sure, have read When Bad Things Happen to Good People, you know, by Rabbi Kushner. He says, in another book I read on forgiveness, he says that according to Judaic law, you can only forgive people who have harmed you. You can't forgive anyone who has harmed someone else because you don't have the right. The only person who can forgive someone is the person who's been harmed. Therefore, he says, the murderer can never be forgiven. But then he goes on, he says, the only hope a murderer has is that he or she has become a different person from the person who committed the murder. And when you look at it from that perspective, and you also look at it from what we're searching for, which is spiritual wholeness, which is a sense of redemption, which is a sense of having a personality change sufficient to overcome compulsive eating, we have a chance. They don't. You know, just knowing that makes such a difference in my life that I have a chance of redemption no matter what I've done. But so many of the people who have harmed me or harmed others never, ever, ever had or will have the chance of redemption, the chance of becoming different from what they used to be. I can only tell you this works for people I know. I can't go much further than that. I can tell you that the people I've sponsored people, or I've talked to people who have been horribly, horribly dealt with, and they've been able to use these concepts not to forgive, but at least not to allow those people to continue doing the horrible things that they did, not to continue being beat up, not to continue to be violated, not to continue to have the past kill them. It's all that's required, because the next part of the big book says, and you have to deal with this, is you have to overcome and deal with tolerance, pity, and patience, those who have harmed you or others, because you're being asked now to put, on page 67, referring to our list again, people may ask, by the way, I left out about eight lines. From my perspective, those are things you do in the present time, not to deal with your past, but to deal with the present. So I'm not going to refer to them again. Anyway, on page 67, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs that others had done, and here the instructions on the sheet are to fold the paper over. Here. And you have, that's what the dotted lines are there for, to fold the paper over so that column 1 is right beside column 4. You're not looking at the specific things that you've written down about what these people have done and how they've affected you. You're putting out of your mind all of that. You're resolutely looking for your own mistakes. This is like a mad pullover, you know, if you remember Mad Men. Fold in, yeah. you've got column 1 and column 2, right? Column 1 and column 4 right next to each other. And the big book asks us to ask ourselves, where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And I think these all require elucidation beyond what the big book provides us, because we are compulsive eaters. Yes.
Is column 1 the people's names?
Yes. Column 1 is the people's names. Not what they've done to us, but the people's names.
So we are looking at the...
We're looking at column 1 and we're looking at column 4. We're not looking at column 2 and 3. Putting aside the wrongs that others have done, that's column 2. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. So we're looking at column 1, and across from column 1, across from the people who've wronged us, across from the people we've wronged, across from the principles that bother us, across from the institutions that bother us, we look now at our own flaws. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened?
Toward that person?
Toward that person, or in relation to that person, institution, or principle. So we're looking at the broad picture, not the specifics. I think this is very important. I think this is Joe and Charlie. I think, unfortunately, their column here begins to peter out in a way that I'm not happy with, but you're looking at that person in relation to your own flaws. You cannot do this until you've really worked through tolerance, pity, and patience for those who've done harm. Right? But once you've done that, you can now look at your side of the page. Okay. Now, since many of us have not done let's put it this way. Selfish. What does selfish mean? Well, we've already described selfish in the discussion preceding step 3. Selfish does not simply mean wanting my way for my purposes to make me feel good or to give me what I want. It's wanting my way for virtuous purposes. For Hitler, how was I selfish? Well, it wasn't because I didn't want people to die. You know, I mean, that's not why I was, that's not, according to the dictionary definition, that's not selfish, not wanting people to die. But from the big book perspective and definition of selfish, yes, I wanted the past not to have occurred. I wanted reality to be different. I wanted my way. I didn't want people to suffer. And from the big book perspective, that's selfishness. So for many of us who are people pleasers and try to be nice and worry about what people think of them so we're not ever doing any harms that we're aware of, sometimes our selfishness is simply in not wanting reality to be reality. Now, sometimes it's far deeper than that, and it is. You know, I mean, my friends who have been horribly dealt with by others, I in my minor relationship in which I felt, badly treated, the selfishness is I wanted that person to continue to love me, might be. You know, I stayed in a relationship where I caused a person to do me harm, which ultimately caused that person to harm himself or herself. Questions are really tough to answer because of the tape, you know. But I have to talk at breaks. So that's the selfish part. And I think it does require a very broad notion of what selfish means in order to explain where we've been selfish in relation to people who have harmed us or who have harmed others. And there are a lot of us who have more on that list than on the list of people we've harmed. Secondly, where have we been dishonest? Well, the big book dealt with people who have lied, cheated, broken, you know, that's their stereotypical person. And some of us have also done that. But many of us have been dishonest. And so clearly dishonest, I lied, I cheated, I stole, I didn't tell the truth, I was, you know, all these things. But there are two other kinds of dishonesty that I think are really worth exploring from the point of view of people pleasers and of, quote, nice people like us, like some of us. One of them is lying to ourselves. You know, when I wrote down under selfish, I didn't want Hitler to have killed millions and millions of people or be responsible for the death of millions of people. When I wrote down on the dishonesty was, he did it before you were born. There's nothing you can do about it. You're not accepting reality. You're lying to yourself about reality. These things happened before you were born. And that's a very broad concept of dishonesty, but it's not unreal, and it's not unreasonable to write down, I don't want reality to exist. That's a dishonesty. That's lying to yourself. I've had friends who've written down, my mother, you know, I wanted my mother to be different from the mother she was. And the dishonesty is, she was the only mother I had. She did the best she knew how to do under the circumstances, which was lousy. Or she will never change, or she has never changed, or she did never change. And I'm lying to myself if I think there could be a change. You know, I've had friends who say, oh, I'm going to that Thanksgiving dinner. I just know my mother-in-law is going to say something that will cause me to eat. And my question is, well, if you know she's going to say it, why will it cause you to eat? You know, only because you think somehow you can change her, and you can't change her. So why don't you treat her as a person who can't change? You're lying to yourself if you think she'll change. And I think there's another aspect to dishonesty which we do not look at very much. And that is that dishonesty can be not telling the truth when the truth should be told. If we are people pleasers, we have not told the truth when the truth should be told. People have been in abusive situations, whether seriously emotionally abusive or physically abusive or sexually abusive, have been silent at certain times. Not when they're 8 years old. I don't mean that at all. I mean when they're older, when they are more capable of doing that. And my friends who suffered as kids understand that, and their experience was, yeah, no, it's not when they're 8 years old. Kids, when they're 8 years old, you don't deserve, there's no guilt, there's no blame, there's nothing. But when you're 20 years old and you don't tell the truth when the truth should be told, you know, if I don't say to someone, you know what, I'm not staying in this relationship because you need psychiatric help, but instead I stay in the relationship thinking that maybe that person will get better, love will conquer all, you know, she can give me all she's got, she gave me all she had, and it wasn't very pleasant. I'm lying to myself, I'm lying to that person, I'm not being honest with that person. I find that a very powerful thing to look at, whether I've been dishonest. Self-seeking. Oh, this is the toughest one. I think self-seeking, there are many different discussions. Blaine's discussion makes no sense to me, although I love him. And you know, he says selfishness is, if you look at the dictionary, selfish is self-seeking, and self-seeking is selfish. So to make the difference, I look at the words self-seeking. And I think of it as seeking myself in others. If you like me, maybe I'm worthy of being liked. If you like me, I'm probably not worthy of being liked, or, you know, things of that sort. It's how I feel about myself in relation to those people, how those people make me feel about myself. In reality, nothing should make me feel good or bad about myself other than whether I have a good relationship with my higher power. That's the only issue with me now. I hope it is anyway. I mean, sometimes I fall back and I have to work on it. But really, the only issue in terms of my own sense of value is whether I'm keeping my conscious contact with the God of my understanding, which is my deepest beliefs. Because if I'm doing that, who cares what people think about me? I'm doing the right things. I'm acting on the right motives. So for me, self-seeking is that aspect of self-esteem, of feeling good about myself or bad about myself by what other people think about me or have done in relation to me or anything of that sort. My friends who were horribly abused will write down under self-seeking, you know, that person made me feel as if I was dirt. And I continue to feel like dirt because of what that person made me feel like. That's self-seeking, I think, from a very broad perspective. I hope that makes sense. And then frightened. Fear. Is there still fear in relation to that? I could write, well, my imaginary wife. I'm afraid the relationship will continue as it is. Or I'm afraid it will sever. It could be both at the same time. I'm afraid, I once gossiped about a person by telling truthful stories about that person. And when I put that person down, selfish, I wanted people to like me. I wanted people to like me more than they liked him. I wanted to have people think badly of him. Dishonest, I wasn't telling the truth when the truth should be told. That person was not well. And what we were laughing at were things that came from a sick mind. And I was not treating him as a sick person. Self-seeking, I want to look better than him. Fear that he would find out. You know, as simple as that. But lots of fears, and you write those down. Now, you're not given a lot of space to write those down, but you don't really need it because you'll find that they're very basic. Very, very, very basic. You're going through a lot of hoops in order to come down to some very simple concepts. And those, I don't know, has anyone ever used these words? Yeah, okay. Have you found them useful in that respect? Yeah, I mean, I have found them very useful, and I found, you know, really revelatory, or they're revelations when I come to these very, oh, that's where I've been dishonest. I haven't told the truth, and the truth should be told. I look at these other people to define how I feel about myself. And it comes down to very basic character defects. I must tell you that I find them much more basic than writing down gossip, jealousy, envy, lust. You know, all the seven deadly sins come from a misreading, by the way, of the AA 12 and 12. If you read the AA 12, 12, 12 chapter, step 4, you'll see that Bill takes all the seven deadly sins and comes down to one of them, pride. Says all of them are manifestations of pride, which is I'm more important than the rest of the world, which is my own concerns and all of these things. I have the right to have my needs and desires met. I find it easier to answer that than to answer questions, have you ever felt lust, disgust? That would take me just a little long to do that. Have you ever felt jealous, disgust? You know, I don't know how to answer those questions. I also know that a lot of ways of doing step four make people feel awful about themselves. And so they say, well, if you're going to do the bad things, you've got to do the good things. Doubles the work that has to be done. But here, you're isolating four character defects. Why do I gossip? To me, gossip is an action. It's not a defect. It's an action I take as a result of defects I have. You know, jealousy is a feeling I have because of defects I have. Four character defects, that's all. Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Very deep. At least, I find it very deep. And I'm buttressed in that by a psychiatrist I showed it to, looked at that and said, this is brilliant. So, that's fine. I mean, I think it's pretty brilliant. That's it on the resentment form. We have now isolated four character defects. Now, could we hand out the fear form? Here's the fear form. I'm going to finish the three forms, and then I'm going to break. Okay? So another 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes.
Are you familiar with the Facebook Awakening method of doing it? Really drawn out.
Well, fiction. Yeah. I've got about 100 different ways of doing that. I've probably read that one, but I don't know.
What is there a name for the book that you were showing?
It's a book that's on that website. Yeah. It's not called anything. This title page was put on by someone else. Well, no, it's a book. It's not my book. I don't take credit. Yeah. If you could just, I'm running out of time, so if I could just go on while we're doing this, while it's being passed out. I've been asked some questions. The book is a book. It doesn't have a title, but you'll see on that webpage, download a book here, so you can download the book. It's a PDF. All of these are PDF documents. oabigbook.info is the website. It's one page with a bunch of links. Okay? All right. Fears. If we have four character defects, the big book says that fear is the number one of those four character defects. It is the worst, they say, because it paralyzes us. Absolutely paralyzes us. Now, Bill says that fear is... there are only two basic fears, and Joe and Charlie add a third one. In 12 and 12, Bill says that, excuse me, there are the fears of not getting what you want or losing what you have. And Joe and Charlie add the fear of being found out, which is pretty good. But whatever the fears are, the instructions, and I'm going to go through this in the form only. I'm not going to make any reference to the book, although you'll find it right in there. And again, go down the columns. You list your fears. Now you got a whole bunch from your resentments. A whole bunch of them. Because, you know, if my imaginary wife is there, under fears, I'm afraid I'll lose the relationship with her. I'm afraid that this is going to, you know, that the relationship will continue as it is. Then I write down my wife. You know, I write down Hitler because I have fears in relation it could happen again. I write down, an ex-girlfriend because I'm afraid that I will continue to enter into relationships such as the one I had. I don't know what I write down. When I deal with career changes, I've written down, I'm afraid of giving up what I know for something I don't know. Okay? But I would write down just in that one little place there on the first column, job change, ex-wife or ex-girlfriend, Hitler, because those that stands for. Because the next column is why I have those fears. Okay. So the first column is you write down your fears. Okay, and you're given on this form, is it 9 or 7 boxes to write the fears down? 8. And then, so you write all your fears down. Now you may have other fears which don't make it to your resentments. I may be afraid of heights, but I may not think about it. It may not have been on my list of resentments because I may not think that it doesn't bother me. I just have avoided heights. You know, I may be afraid of walking in some part of the world, or some part of my city. I had a fear, it didn't enter my mind because I blocked it very much, but because of certain legal substances I took, they were legal, that I took twice in the 60s, I was actually afraid that this podium or things like this podium would actually start writhing like a snake. That they were always in motion and that there was a possibility that somehow they could overcome me and become different things. Talk about a control freak, that I was needed in order to keep them solid. I was keeping the world together. Talk about control freak. It also comes from a Philip K. Dick book called The Eye in the Sky, which is one of the most frightening science fiction novellas I've ever read. Don't read it. At any rate, what was the name? I'm not telling you. Yeah. But anyway, so that was a fear I wrote down because it's a fear I had, but not a fear that I put down on my resentment list. So you write down your fears. It's column 1. Column 2, why do you have those fears? What we discover in a lot of column 2, and I find it really fascinating, what we discover is that some of the fears we have actually have some reason behind them. Mostly, many of them will, but then as we increase the fears and keep writing down the reasons, the fears become more and more ridiculous. My 19-year-old daughter goes backpacking in Europe. I'm worried she'll hurt herself. I'm worried she won't know how to get hold of us. I'm worried that she's not going to enjoy herself. I'm worried that she's going to be abducted by white traders and taken to Southeast Asia. Well, that becomes just a little bit more ridiculous. It's not it's unreasonable, but not absolutely impossible. So my fears become as I write them down. So I write those fears down. And we begin in column 2 to realize some of them actually have some reasonable understanding, a reason behind them, and some of them don't. So in the second column, we begin to understand that we have taken our fears and magnified them, often magnified them, to a point beyond reasonableness and beyond probability. But anyway, we write them down. The next column is the gimme column, where you're relying on your infinite, on your finite self or upon infinite God. That's a gimme. If you answer, oh, I was relying upon infinite God, you're lying. Because if you're relying on your infinite God, you would not be afraid of anything. So you write down yes. Or you put a check mark. The computer does a beautiful job of looking at it. And the next column is a gimme. Did it work? Did relying on your finite self work? No, it didn't, because otherwise you wouldn't have any fear. So you check, it didn't work. And you go down these columns partly because you want to look at patterns. You want to see these patterns of fear. And then you say the fear prayer. And the fear prayer is a brilliant prayer. God, please remove this particular fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be, not do, but be. I find that brilliant. Because you think, what you have me do about this fear? You may do nothing about the fear. But what would you have you be is very important. And then there's a column there. Well, what would God have you be? You're doing this for the first time. You might not know yet what God would have you be. But I'll give you some example. You might want to work with your sponsor or work with someone and help you understand. But I can tell you, I'll go through a few of the fears I've had, and I can tell you what God would have me be, what I've worked out for myself. Hitler, right? Why is Hitler on my list? Could happen again. Sometimes I write down, is happening again. Those are the reasons I have the fear. What would God have me be? Now, you know, what would God, I'm looking at a gentleman who, how could you pray to God that you don't think exists, right? And I can only say, I pray to have a direct connection with the things I believe in, and I meditate to hear in my own heart what those things I believe in would direct me to do, or the direction I'm going in. Okay? So what would God have me be in relation to Hitler? A person who accepts the past and does his best to prevent anything from happening that might harm people. That's the best I can be in relation to that. I can't do anything more. I can't be anything more than that. In relationship to my daughter in Europe, what would God have me be? A loving, honest father who makes himself available to his daughter and helps her whenever there's need. What else can I be in relation to that? I'm afraid of walking in parts of my hometown. What would God have me be? A prudent person, because I shouldn't take any risks, not only because I shouldn't take any risks to keep my own life, but also because I have people who rely on me and who love me, and I shouldn't take any unreasonable risks, and who acts reasonably in accordance with his concerns. Well, my fears have now become strategies.
A person who accepts
the limitations that he has and does what he can to change. A prudent person. You know, the Big Book promises us that we will outgrow fear. What that means is we develop a maturity towards those concerns. They may be reasonable, but I'll tell you this, if I had a 2-year-old daughter and my 2-year-old daughter phoned me from the danger zone of my city, well, there is no danger zone in my city. I lived in Chicago in Hyde Park in 1967. That was not a happy time, a very unhappy time in Chicago. And my city is nothing like, in any part of my city is nothing like what Chicago was in 1967. But at any rate, if a 2-year-old or 5-year-old were lost in that part of town, I would go there. Because I would be a prudent person who takes reasonable risks. You know? So, I'm not afraid of that town anymore, but I may avoid that part of town unless I have to be there for reasons that are more significant than the prudence that I have to show. It's real simple once you look at it that way. And you begin to outgrow fear because the things you fear, you know, I'm holding together the podium, you know, with my sheer will. A person who accepts that generally speaking, space and time can take care of themselves. And atoms can whirl around, and generally speaking, they don't stray from their orbit unless there's nuclear fission going on, in which case, we're all dead. You know, I mean, you know, a person who accepts reality is sometimes it comes down to simple ideas. And the most amazing thing is that all these complex fears that just cloud our minds come into very simple answers. A person will lose his friends. I mean, I'm worried about losing my friends. I'm worried about losing my relationships. I'm worried about, you know, this relationship is no good or that relationship or something like that. A person who is loving, honest, and compassionate. When my older girl was between 12 and 16, having real trouble at school, very smart kid, obviously, I've told you stories about her, but having trouble at school, my fears, of course, she wouldn't go on. She'd ruin herself. She'd end up not doing things that she's capable of doing. And what would God have me be? A loving and honest father who was available when needed and let her live her life and learn from her own mistakes. That's what I, and I'm telling you, when I realized that was it, there are slightly more things that went on, the dynamics between my wife and me, where she's a great arguer, so she was arguing with me and driving my wife crazy too. And I was accepting the arguments because I love the intellectual battles that I was having with a 12-year-old. I was admiring this kid. She had spunk, you know. It's like, Mary Tyler Moore, you have spunk. I hate spunk. You know, but anyway, as soon as I realized that I have to be loving and honest and compassionate, but let her make her own mistakes, my goodness, this little kid grew up into a tremendously mature, wonderful kid. You know? So these were the simple things. It was, I mean, simple advice. Real simple advice that anyone could have given me, but that I couldn't accept because I was full of fear. When I go through these forms, I outgrow the fear. I'm not going to go on with those. Could we pass on the sex conduct form? That's fear. And by the way, if any of you have a particular fear and you want me to help you work it through, I've had a lot of experience doing it, a lot of people helping me work out my fears, I'd be happy to share whatever I've got. I'll do the sex conduct, then we'll break, but we'll only break for a short time, 7 minutes. I was told to use an odd number because that means people will come back on time. If you give them 10 minutes, they won't come back on time. Now, we dealt with fear. We're outgrowing fear. You know, we dealt with fear. We have three other character defects: selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking. And the big book will now have us deal with sex conduct. Now, sex, in 1939 when the book was published, sex did not mean what it means today. Today, sex refers basically to the physical acts of sex, sexual intercourse, sexual intimacy of some kind. But back in 1939, it meant that, but it also meant far more. It meant basically relationships in which there was attraction. Some kind of physical attraction. That's what it meant. And my proof is that James Thurber and E.B. White, the great New Yorker essayist and humorist, wrote a book called Is Sex Necessary in 1939, and it was all about relationships. It was not a funny book, but it was about relationships and not about, it included sexual, but they skirted around that quite a bit. And so sex was much broader. So sex conduct, from the big book perspective, I think, means relationships in which there was some kind of imbalance of attraction and relationship. Those are difficult with relationships. Aside from family relationships, they're probably the most complex.
Imbalance
between attraction and relationship. This form is, what we're doing here is we're trying out our character defects on these difficult relationships. It's almost like a rehearsal for how we can have other relationships dealt with as well, how we can deal with other relationships. So again, it's in different columns. First, we write out the names of the people whom we've harmed. Now, I didn't have many girlfriends before I got married, but of those I had relationships with, there were a few I didn't harm. We had good, equal relationships. There's nothing wrong. We had fun. And it ended, and there was no hurt involved. And there were some in which there was hurt involved. Sometimes I was hurt, but when I look at what I've already done, my selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, if I wasn't honest and didn't tell the truth and stayed in a relationship for all kinds of reasons and allowed that person to continue to harm me, I harmed that person. So I put that person down. On the other hand, there were people, Don spoke yesterday about how he hardened himself, it'll never happen to me again. That happened with me. I was hurt in a relationship. I hurt 3 or 4 other people because I wouldn't let myself, I wouldn't let my defenses down. And I wasn't there for these women. And I used them in the same way that this other person might have used me. So I wrote them down. So you write down, and my wife is always going to, well, she's not always on the list these days, but she was certainly on the list when I first started. That's column one. Column two is, where was I selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Inconsiderate is not looking out for them, but looking for my part of it. Right? Self-seeking, looking for me. So I've got selfish, dishonest, self-seeking. I'm basically repeating what I wrote down in the last column in the resentment form. I'm repeating it and maybe analyzing it a bit better in the second column of the sex conduct form. Okay? You just write it out. Again, point four, doesn't really matter that much. But you write out the ways in which you've harmed that person, where you've been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate or self-seeking. Next column is, did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? By the way, I should say, I wrote down things as deep as my relationship with my wife or this relationship I had that hurt me. I also wrote down, you may laugh, most people do, I, for a long time, had this awe of women who looked like Mary Tyler Moore. You know, the very thin, the high cheekbones, the overbite, the slight overbite, the large mouth, the, I don't know, something about them. And I actually knew some people who looked like that. I mean, didn't look exactly like, but had those characteristics. And I wrote down, there was one who was the mother of a girl in my daughter's, at a team that my daughter was in. I wrote her down because I didn't treat her as I treated all the other parents. You know? I also wrote down we have a couple we're very close to, and I used to flirt with the wife. Nothing would ever happen. She was deeply in love with her husband. I'm deeply in love with my wife. But there was sexual flirtation going on. I wrote it down because it didn't seem to me to be right. So I didn't just write down relationships in which there was some intimacy. I wrote down relationships in which there was something else going on. Very broad. So where was I selfish in relation, say, to the mother of the kid? I didn't treat her like another parent. I didn't include her in conversations. I'm a pretty sociable guy. And I would sit down with all the other parents and we'd talk while the kids were practicing, for instance. But I wouldn't talk to her. And she was a very isolated person. She'd read, you know? So I didn't involve her. That was selfish. I probably acted differently towards her, wanting her to like me in a certain way, right? I don't know. I don't remember what I wrote about her. But whatever it is, selfish. Dishonest, she's just another mother. She's not Mary Tyler Moore. And anyway, Mary Tyler Moore is just a figment of my imagination. Mary Tyler Moore, in reality, is a woman and a person and not this. She's not Mare. You know, she's not this wonderful, vulnerable person that we saw in the Mary Tyler Moore show. She is who she is. I won't give you the details of what I wrote down about my wife, but let's write down the imaginary wife, you know, wanting sex when she doesn't want it, not thinking only of my own needs, things of that sort. Dishonest, I've written down not being honest about the relationship. I've written down not being honest about my part in the relationship. And what I have not told and what I haven't said, under self-seeking is, under inconsiderate is not thinking of her needs, not thinking of other people's needs, things like that. It's real simple, basic, that's where I've done them harm. With the woman I flirted with, our friend, did I arouse jealousy? I know I didn't. No one was jealous. My friend, my close male friend and my wife, they weren't jealous of us. They knew that there was nothing going on. Suspicion, absolutely not. Bitterness, maybe, because there was an edge to what we were doing that really wasn't nice. And it was this sexual thing going on, and I don't know what it was, but I put down bitterness. Ex-girlfriend, selfish, wanted her to be someone who she wasn't. Dishonest, she's never going to change, and I allowed her to continue to harm me and didn't tell her I'm out of this relationship. Self-seeking, she was gorgeous. She made me feel as if I was in a Clairol advertisement with the backlight, you know, running in slow motion towards her on a wheat field, you know, with the wheat going back and forth. That's how she made me feel. It's true. I didn't think that was my imagination, but sort of. But that's how, you know, so I used her. You know, she made me feel more handsome than I thought I was. She made me feel more attractive than I thought I was. And that was worth the real emotional turmoil that she put me through. Okay, the next part of the form is, where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? Here the big book says, we're looking to mold our ideals for the future, for future relationships. Here is where we learn how we can act in an unselfish, honest, and considerate, non-self-seeking way. So now we're taking these difficult relationships and we're learning from them about how we can live a life that's not selfish, that is considerate, and that is honest. What should I have done? Let's say, take the imaginary wife. Loved the wife. Well, you know what? All of these come down to real simple things. Either stop and get out of the relationship, or spend more time making it better, thinking of the other person rather than myself. There are a few other choices in this thing. That's basically what it is. And so I learn that in all relationships, I have to think of the other person and not of myself. And if that other person is sick or the relationship is sick, to get out of the relationship. And there isn't much more to it than that. I've talked too long. Can we come back at 4 o'clock on the dot so I can get on with this? Thank you.
What was your definition of self-esteem?
Self-esteem is how I feel about myself.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I just love it. Okay. So, like, my part of a resentment. Oh, no, fear. Sorry. Fear about finding work and figuring out what I want to do because I'm changing career.
Well, I've been through there.
Have you?
Yeah, I have, actually. Yeah.
So what would God have me be?
A person who trusts that truth, love, justice, and beauty, or your God. That if I work on that, I will find fulfillment. If I work on my contact with God, I will find fulfillment.
Got it. Perfect.
I want to give you one story, and I may tell this again, so pardon me for that. Yeah.
If I
that I will be fulfilled. Pardon me?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I may tell the story, but I had a friend who went into bankruptcy after being quite wealthy. I saw him, he was an AA guy, and I saw him a year later, and he was looking very happy, but down, I mean, he didn't have a lot of money. I said, what are you doing? He said, he's an AA guy, really strong. He said, I'm an orderly in a hospital. I clean shit off men and give them dignity. There's a person who was fulfilled in his life because he understood that he was helping other people, no matter how lowly what he was doing was, because he was fulfilling his higher power. And that's, I mean, I'll tell you, when I did this, and I'll be able to talk about that tomorrow, I hope I will, I had big career change. I wanted to get out of law and get into mediation. But I knew that I could not, if I left, I could not do both because of the particular practice I had in the area I wanted to do mediation in. And I had to discuss with my wife because I owed a duty to my wife, my kids are grown up, she's retired, so I owed a duty to her. So my fears, you know, what will God have me be in life? My fears, a prudent person who doesn't make moves without discussing with his wife and without having a backup plan, without having a strategy. As I went through my job changes, I did a step 10 on this about 6 times. And at times it came down to the honesty about my job. My current job was, it's better than anything than an alternative. It gives me more flexibility. It gives me a good income. And I'm not harming anyone, and occasionally I do good. And my dishonesty was, I want to be 100% fulfilled, whereas most people are sometimes not even 1% fulfilled. And I was at least 20% fulfilled. You know what I'm saying? So, but as time went on and I began to see another alternative, I became a person who prepares himself to change jobs by both knowing that he has the money for a transition and is trained and has the credentials to do the other job. So that said, okay, fine. That means I have to take courses. It means I have to plan. And if the planning works out, then maybe I can change jobs. So, you know, this is a transition. That makes sense?
Great, yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You had said when you were talking about after you write your fears, I think it was the third card about was I depend relying on my infinite self or
Infinite God or finite self.
And you said if you rely on infinite God, then there's no reason to fear. Why?
Because if you rely on God, why should you feel fear about anything? If God is infinite, what are you afraid of? If you rely on infinite God and not your finite self, we're arguing about nothing. The concept there is, if infinite God were in you, you would feel no fear. Now, that's the words I think that the Big Book has used. The Big Book says, we clearly saw that we relied on our finite selves rather than infinite God. If I rely on truth, love, justice, and beauty, that they are the most important things in my life, then I will go through life unharmed. Because no matter what I, whether I live or die, or whether I suffer or don't suffer, I will have lived my life according to what I believe in. But clearly, if I'm afraid, I'm not living my life according to that. Does that help?
I think I just, people tell me all the time, oh, God has your back.
I don't believe that.
Okay, so, and that's where I struggle.
Yeah. You see, I don't have that kind of God.
Yeah, or that, you know, God has a plan for you.
Yeah, I don't believe that. Yeah, and nothing, I mean, I love the acceptance prayer, page 449 or whatever the current page is, but I don't believe that nothing happens in God's universe without a purpose. I believe that everything happens without a purpose. I don't have a purpose. I don't think there's a purpose other than what we make out of it. So what? I do have a duty, though, to accept reality. And not to be afraid of it, not to have it paralyze me beyond what realistic concerns have me take care with. I don't want to wander into battle zone. Does that make sense? Okay. I'll talk more about it.
I'm
doubtful too.
Is it doubtful?
Sure I am.
Fearful.
I have been fearful. But if you write them down, first off, you see how fear is paralyzing you.
Yeah.
And you pray to have whatever God you believe in, whatever that's, you know, to remove your fears and direct your attention to what you have you be. You meditate on the concept of what it would be, and work with someone else. Okay, work with someone who's been there. I think you'll get help. And if you ever want any suggestions from me, I'll be happy to email me, and I'll be happy to correspond. Well, my email address is on that website.
Oh, okay.
There's a place to click on it, and you can just, you'll get an email, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thanks.
When you restart, there's somebody's cell phone sitting on the floor right over by that pillar.
Okay.
I have no idea who.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. I didn't force stuff one where I didn't get through it to go around me. And what they had me do was, and I've done it a few times, and that's...
This way? Or in...
No,
oh, yeah.
I'll tell you what they had me do, because it didn't make sense, but, you know, when you're in a position and you're...
Yeah, you do what they tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've done it twice, and I stop.
It's overwhelming. You get depressed. You feel worse about yourself and all that.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, they had me write down everybody in my entire life I've ever known.
Yeah.
And I was just like... you know, the perfectionist that I am.
Yes, who is grade 4 or grade 3? Yeah, yeah, I know that.
So I did it, and I had this notebook with everyone, and just, I was like, I don't know, like, it didn't make sense. So I feel like I'm going to try it a different way, and I feel like this way is, like, really...
Very practical, yeah.
Yeah, very practical, so I just was terrified things to do, so, like, I've done a lot of different
things. Thank you. Okay, could I start again?
Yeah.
Pardon? Yes. Yeah. Can I start again, please? Okay, we're rushing through. We're in steps 5 through 9. So let me please get it done if I can. Listen, step 4 is that simple from a big book perspective. Okay? It shouldn't take you, if you add up the number of hours that are required to fill out those forms in as much detail as you want, with as many fears and with as many resentments, with as many relationships as you've had in your life, you can't persuade me that it would take you longer than a total of 24 to 36 hours to fill those things out. You would want to space them out. I understand why you would want to, but it wouldn't take you a total of that many hours, more than that many hours. Now, contrast that, and note that the hope that you're getting as you work through these forms is you start with isolating the things that are killing you, and you end up to see the openings for things that can change you. So you're ending up not just seeing the bad things, but you're ending up at the end of step 4 with the good things. You don't need to write out all the bad things. This isn't going to make you feel guilty. We're all selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. You're not terminally unique. All the horrible things you've done in your life are part and parcel of the same character defects that all of us share. So it's not going to depress the hell out of you and require you to write down the good things. You're not writing the history of your life from cradle, from the womb to the current time. You're not answering 170 or 250 questions. You know, you're not having someone else's sense of what of the kind of person you should be imposing on you. You know, have you ever felt lust? I've seen one. There's one that just kills me. It's 25 pages long. There's 10 pages on sex written by someone who must have written it in the 40s or something. You know, it's so prudish. It's so, you know, if you ever have an extramarital relationship, if you ever lived with a person without marrying them, oh, geez. I mean, that's not quite, you know, and this, yeah, so I don't even remember, but it probably says if you ever had a homosexual relationship, you know. So, I mean, some of these things impose other people's values. This imposes no values other than your own, the things you believe in deeply. And it only puts down, you only put down the things that are bothering you, and you want to get rid of them. Okay. So the only promises in the big book are found on page 70. I do encourage you, read the book on this. Don't just use the forms. Read the book because there's so much value in there. But you'll notice the sex conduct form is, what should we have done instead? And in this way, it says, we hope to mold our ideals for the future. So we're learning from the past about how we could have acted differently for future relationships. Okay. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. That's a promise, I guess. We've listed and analyzed our resentments, yes. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. So futility is how useless they are. Fatality is how they're killing us. We've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. They're killing us. We've begun to learn. We haven't yet completely learned. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience and goodwill toward all men and women, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we've hurt by our conduct, because they're now there. We know the harm we've done. We know where we've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, and are willing to straighten out the past if we can, because in the fear and sex conduct form, we've seen a glimmer of what it would be like if we were different. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. I've tried to parse that sentence. I know what it means, but boy, if I ever did a sentence diagram on that, I have no idea where the prepositions go and the pronouns go. Anyway, if you have already made a decision, step three, and an inventory, step four, of your grosser handicaps. Grosser here doesn't mean the yucky ones. It means the big ones, the thick ones, the bad ones, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. A very good overeater promise. Now, when I first did this, my first sponsor said to me after 6 weeks, have you finished step four? I said, no, it's not right yet. There's still more to do. I haven't yet. He says, just do it. Get it done. You'll have a chance to do it over again. And as we'll find out in step 10, I use these forms very often. Very often. I just did one. Should have done it 5 months earlier, but I just did one. So it's the big stuff. And you'll find as you do this how big it is. And actually, when we get to step 5, I'll point out there's a checklist of promises at a certain point in step 5, which if you haven't felt the feelings that they think you should feel, mean that you should go back and do another step four. Not to repeat what you've done, but there's something you left out. So step five, partway through step five, most ways through step five. Okay. I'm not going to read to you the beginning of chapter 6. Remember, it was written for people who did not have anyone from AA around. And there's a lot of it. First of all, they say, why should you do a step five? You know, admitted to God, to ourselves as another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. They say there are many reasons. We'll give you the best one first. They never give you another one. The best one first is you'll die if you don't. That's a good reason. That's a good enough reason. But I'll give you a few others. One is just the value of confessing what bothers you about yourself to another human being. There is something about unburdening that the Catholic Church certainly discovered and certainly is true. It's just you're getting it off your chest. Secondly, you're telling it to a person who almost certainly will say to you, I understand exactly where you're coming from. I have harbored these feelings. I have felt these things. I have done things like that. So you're learning that you're not alone and that someone understands you and still likes you. And that's a very powerful statement just in and of itself. Thirdly, if you allow it to happen, I encourage you to do it, you're going to get feedback from that person. And that person will say to you, or I hope will ask you questions that are designed to help you understand yourself better. I learned the first step, 5, that I heard, I did with a person. I didn't know how to do it efficiently, so it took us like 10 hours over 2 days. Towards the end of the first day, that person said, and then I did this, this, and this. And I said, what are you putting that down? That's not important. That's nothing. You shouldn't even have that down. Came back the next day. This is a guy who'd been in AA for years. He said to me, listen, this is my inventory. It's not yours. I feel bad about that. And you have no right to tell me that I shouldn't feel bad about it. He was absolutely right. So I've never done that since. But what I have done is ask questions. I have said things like, well, you know, I'm not saying that you should feel this way, but if I had done this, I might feel this or I might feel that. I don't know, does that ring a bell? Does that help you at all? Things of that sort. And I encourage people to help me in that respect too. Very often a beginner will not know how to, will have left blanks under selfish or left blanks under dishonest or left blanks under self-seeking or under frightened in the thing. I often will help them by saying, well, you know, describe the situation and maybe I can help you see at least where I might feel that way. So I'm getting feedback. And the feedback I seek and the feedback I ask people to give me is whether I may be too hard on myself or too easy. Usually it's too easy on myself. I'm looking for that feedback. We're all the same. I'm sure many of you have heard, well, because he lives here, Clancy I from California, from Los Angeles, who's this great AA speaker, one of the funniest, most powerful speakers I've ever heard on tape, never heard him in person. But he talks about hearing a step 5 from someone, and he talks about they're driving and he's driving the car in a rainstorm. The windshield wiper's going back and forth, and it's dark, and this guy has a flashlight, and he's reading, you know. And then Clancy, I did this, and then I did that, and you know, he's confessing, and Clancy's saying, "Does he know what I'm thinking? Oh God, not another one. Exactly the same. Why can't I get a murderer someday?" I mean, it's a pretty awful statement, you know, but it's funny. Because we are all the same. And we learn that we're the same. Because when it comes to selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, we've all been there. You know? It's not as if it's a revelation. So, that's the big book says, those are good reasons. In addition, you'll die if you don't. The rest of on pages 73 and 74, they tell you how to find someone to give it to. Because if you're alone and there's no AA in your town, because this book was written for people who didn't have AA around, you have to find someone. They say, well, find someone outside of your own acquaintance, a psychologist, a clergy person, a respected person, someone you can tell it to. I should point out that on page 96, once you've recovered yourself and you're ready to sponsor, the big book says, now that you have recovered, let this person know that you're available to make a decision, because the big book says we should take step 3 with another person, a spiritual advisor or a loved one, if possible, or tell his story, which is step 5. Let him know you're available. But if you want to tell a story to someone else, don't bother about it. Don't mind about it. So you're available if you are ready to sponsor, you're available to hear it. I have personally found telling my story, my step 5, works best if I tell it to someone in the program. But not always. And I have sometimes used other people. Mostly I've used OA people. Sometimes I've used AA people. And sometimes I've used people who aren't. I've done step 5s with my wife. She's my best friend and understanding. She's not on the list. Sometimes I do it with her.